If you used a touchscreen today, it is based on the technology of inventor and entrepreneur Hal Philip. What does it take to bring such a creative idea from conception to market? We find out next as we talk to inventor and entrepreneur Hal Philip on Mind Matters.
Welcome to Mind Matters, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
Build a better mousetrap and the world will beat a path to your door. Today, this is far from true. Small entrepreneurs fall in the shadow of large corporate giants like Google, Microsoft, and Amazon. So what does it take to bring a clever idea to market? We talk today to Hal Philip, the inventor and entrepreneur who made touchscreens inexpensive and whose technology is today used all over the world. You have probably used Hal Philip's invention today. Hal Philip is the founder and former owner of Quantum Research. His company was sold to Atmel in 2008. Am I saying that right, Atmel?
Yes, you are.
Okay, good. And Hal Philip has over 80 patents. He actually can't count them all since some of them were in process when he sold the company and he really hasn't followed up to find out whether they were granted or not.
That's true.
Yeah. Okay. I first met Hal in 1987 when he was a budding entrepreneur working on many R&D projects. Hal, when we first met, you were working on some really interesting projects. One I recall was a robot boxer. This was way before its time in 1987. What was the robot boxer all about? I remember going in there and it would punch you and all sorts of interesting things.
Yeah, this was the brainchild of one Jerry Wilson, who was the founder of Soloflex. I don't know if any of you in the audience know the company Soloflex, but they pioneered the home gym equipment to using the resistance training, using rubber bands, basically just giant rubber bands. And this guy made a huge business out of it outside of Oregon, near Hillsboro somewhere.
It really shows what you can do if you're an entrepreneur and you just have rubber bands and need something to do with them, I guess.
Yeah, okay. You have to do something with those rubber bands, that's right. So he had a huge factory and he wanted to broaden his horizons into other areas, I guess. He was making lots of money. By the way, he pioneered telemarketing on these half-hour infomercials on television. He was the pioneer of those.
Really?
Yes. He used really attractive young people, and he had them exercising away, and he sold a ton of product that way.
And I bet you he showed a lot of guys with big muscles.
He did. Yeah. He showed a lot of guys with big muscles, beautiful bodies, all that stuff.
Okay.
Anyway, he got it in his head that he wanted to diversify into other areas, and one of them was, well, boxing, and he wanted to create something you could exercise with to go along with his other equipment, I suppose, that would help you spar, a sparring partner. So a boxing robot was what he had in mind. And so he had a mechanical engineer who did some of the work, but he couldn't figure out how to control the thing. It had a very heavy-duty motor inside of it and so on, and he needed somebody to do the control hardware and the software and everything to make this boxing robot box. It was a bit of a ludicrous contraption, to be honest, a little bit flimsy, but it did do its job. But I think ultimately he saw the light when his lawyers probably told him that this was probably a good way to end up in litigation.
I guess so.
When
so,
somebody got their lights knocked out of them.
Was it his idea to market these things?
Yeah, of course. He was going to build them and market them. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And so that was it was a fun project, and I got some photos of that. Jerry Wilson himself was quite the character, so but that's a different story for another time.
And
I guess
we probably don't want to go there from things you've told me. So,
yeah, probably don't want to go there entirely. Yeah.
But he was a nice guy, right?
Yeah, he did write a book about his time, and I think he's deceased now. But if you look up Jerry Wilson on Amazon, you will find out that he wrote a book.
Now, you also had a lot of success with optical sensors. And they were used, for example, on automated doors and water faucets and
yes,
other sort of things. Could you elaborate on that? What was the principle behind your optical sensor and how you marketed it to do some of these different applications?
Sure. So to give a little bit of context, my optical work started at a company called Tektronix in Beaverton, Oregon. They're very famous for test and measurement equipment dating back to pre-World War II days. So anyway, I was working on an optical fiber cable tester. It's called an OFTDR in the industry, or optical fiber time domain reflectometer. And it sends an optical pulse down a fiber, and you can see where the breaks are or any discontinuities are in the fiber many kilometers away.
Is this time domain reflectometry, kind of?
Yes, it is time. It's optical time domain reflectometry. And I was responsible for the time-based section and also for the microprocessor control section. I wrote the firmware for it and so on. So that was at Tektronix in the late 70s. And I kind of got an itch after that. That became a very successful product, by the way. It lasted in the marketplace for about a decade. So that was hugely successful. In the T&M world, that's quite unusual. Anyway, I got the bug to go off and do something on my own. So I did some consulting work for another company in the area, also doing optical work in the same vein. Their name was Photon Kinetics, started by a certain PhD. His name was Phil Shearer. Anyway, he was quite a guy. He was running his operation out of the garage. That's now become a fairly large company, as I understand. And so I was doing optical things. I found myself doing all this optical stuff. And so I wanted to find a way to make money as an independent contractor or consultant in that industry. It was burgeoning or just budding at that time, I should say. And so I started designing optical sensors and came up with an idea for an application I called it the photon bridge. In fact, you and I did a paper on
this. We did
a paper together on it.
That's right. Is it okay if we link that on the podcast?
Yes, you
notes?
Can. Sure, okay, absolutely. Link it on the podcast.
So this is
notes.
My brush with greatness.
This is good. No, it's my brush with greatness. So anyway.
We're a mutual admiration
okay,
society.
Mutual, anyway. So I did this sensor and got filed for a patent on it, and I nicknamed it the photon bridge because it looked like an optical version of an electrical bridge circuit. And you have to be an electrical engineer, I guess, to know what that really means. But anyway, it was kind of novel and it was worth a patent. I got a patent granted. And then I was looking for places to get revenue from this patent. To get revenue, you have to license it or create a product and sell it. Something like that.
Now, this is an interesting aspect. I think a lot of engineers think if they create a new project, that immediately, as we said in the introduction, the world is going to beat a path to your door. But that's not true. You have to package it. You have to market it. And as a single entrepreneur, you did all of this.
Yes, I did. Yeah, wow. I was a one-man band. That's true. I don't recommend doing that necessarily, but it is certainly one approach, and I did that, and I did it quite successfully. There was a lot of trials and tribulations on the way. Anyway, about this optical bridge patent. So I found a company out of Sweden. They had a U.S. Subsidiary called BESAM, B-E-S-A-M. They still exist today. I think they got bought out by another company, but it doesn't matter. Anyway, they had did automatic doors for grocery stores and airports, the kind that open sideways when you walk into them. They did swing doors, too, but mostly they did sliding doors. And these doors had a problem in that when you stood in the middle of them, they typically would tend to close after a little while and hit you. And if you were an elderly person with a walker or a cane or something and you couldn't move out of the way fast enough, you'd get hit. And then you would fall over, you'd break your hip, you'd get an embolism, and sometimes people died. So this was a constant source of litigation for these companies, and they needed a way to avoid trapping people or getting people hit by these doors when they came closed. So they were looking for some kind of an optical system to do that. Back then, cameras were not a thing because it was just too expensive to do optical processing. So my patent came in because I could do a light curtain from the top looking down at the floor, and it could be very, very sensitive, and it could detect if anything was in that doorway just before the doors would close. So it was an interesting project. It was a very difficult, challenging project, actually, but for me, ultimately, financially, it was also very rewarding. It was my first patent license ever. The company gave me a $50,000 advance, which at that time was a small fortune. It certainly was a fortune to me. And I thought, wow, this the American dream is coming true for me, you know. So I then proceeded to do the development. So I got paid even more work to do the development work for BESAM. And then later when it went into serial production, of course, I got royalties from it.
Now, is your technology currently being used or a modification of it?
I don't know for a fact if it is. I've lost track. That patent long since expired. So it could be that it's being used, but I would have no way to track that now because it is an expired patent. So that dated back to around 1987.
I see.
Yeah. And I did use that patent for other things. So I did get into the automatic faucet business. That was another area where people were using optical sensors to detect your hand and to make the water come on in washrooms, for example, at airports and restaurants and McDonald's and so on. And so I started doing sensors in there, in that area. It was a very interesting area because optical sensors, of course, pick up on the proximity of an object, but also based on the color of the object. So if you have dark hands, these optical sensors that were out there didn't react too well. So they were a little bit racist, to be blunt about it.
Racist sensors.
And we can't have that in society. No, of course not. So, no, seriously, it's a big problem. So I had a sensor that was much more sensitive. It really didn't care about the color of your skin. And so it got an immediate audience in the plumbing industry. And I did license agreements with several of the big plumbing companies back in the late 80s and early 90s. And
so same question. Do you know if your technology is currently being used at all, or you haven't followed
it? It's an expired patent, and I suspect there are – I probably is, yeah. I don't know for a fact. It probably is, yeah. But so, I don't know. I haven't researched it. I've gone long past that in my career, so –
Now, you moved your business from the U.S. to England, I think, in 1996. And you told me that you accidentally formed a company as a result of that move.
Yeah, that was...
Tell us what happened. Why did you move to the U.S. to England?
From the U.S. to England? Well, I was living in Florida at the time, and I was still doing this optical sensing stuff, and I had also migrated over towards the capacitive version of my patent. So I had was filing patents in the capacitive realm to do electric field sensing and proximity sensing in a similar way to the optical stuff, but shorter range, less power consumption, and had a lot of human and industrial kind of applications associated with it. I first did this technology to benefit the plumbing companies, the automatic faucet companies, because they had asked me for a sensor that would operate on batteries for up to 5 years on a single battery.
Wow.
And you couldn't do that with optics. The energy requirements were just too extreme. And when I pointed that out, they said, well, see if you can find something else. So I did. I started to go into capacitive sensing, and that's what made me segue from optical into capacitive sensing. Because capacitive sensing uses electric fields. Electric fields consume nanowatts of power, very low amounts of energy. And they're fairly robust, but only over very short ranges, which is fine for an optical, for a faucet sensor. And so I developed one for the plumbing industry, and I did my own video of it and everything. I did my marketing video. I took a page out of Jerry Wilson's handbook on how to market stuff. And
Jerry, you have to educate us.
From Soliflex.
The Soliflex, the boxing robot guy. He did the
infomercial. So
okay.
I did my own video of this product and everything, and I took it around. I made prototypes and took them around.
This was before YouTube, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. It was before course. Internet. So
wow, okay. Yes.
There was no internet at the time. I think there were bulletin boards. Remember bulletin
boards? Yes, I did.
Yes, there were dial-up bulletin boards.
Yes.
Well, that wasn't a very effective way of doing any marketing at all. So I sent around VHS tapes. Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
Totally obsolete.
Very obsolete now.
Very 20th century.
Very 20th century. Very amusing. Anyway, I sent around these tapes, and I sent around some, made some prototypes and shipped them around to different companies. And all of them said, well, that's very nice, Hal. You know, it works great, but, you know, it's so different and new. We have to put it on test now for 20 years. So
20 years?
Come back in 20 years.
And then your patent would be over, right?
Yes, of course. It'd be over at that point. So I only had luck with one company that decided that they would buy for a fixed fee up front a license to it. And then but I don't know if they did very much with it past that point. So I did develop it for them. I don't think they ever went into production with it, though. Again, this fear in the marketplace of something too radically new.
So again, what brought you to England?
Well, that's the background of the story. That's what got me into capacitive sensing. And I was frustrated now because this capacitive sensing technology wasn't getting any customers. I couldn't find any customers for this. And I knew it was unique. It was new. It was different. It was a technology and solution in search of a problem to solve. And in a trip that I had done to Europe in around 1995, I found a company in England that was interested in some kind of a joint venture to pursue the industrial market, mostly in Europe, for proximity sensors for machine tool controls and things of that nature. Conveyor belt sensing to sense if a package or, you know, some nuts and bolts were coming down the line, or a car or something like that, robotics and so on. So I said, okay, well, I have nothing else going on. This technology isn't getting any other takers. So, and I had a German passport as well as an American. And my wife at the time had an Irish. So I said, let's move to England. We'll be there for 2-3 years. We'll get this company set up as a joint venture kind of deal. And then we'll come back to the States. And so in 1997, we packed up our belongings and sold the house in Florida and moved over to England in a little village called Hamble, H-A-M-B-L-E, on the south coast near Southampton, England. And the company that I was partnering with was not too far away. And yeah, so that's what brought me over there. So it was supposed to be a couple or 3 years. I rented a house instead of buying a house there, figuring out would be a short-term proposition. And then after a few months of working with this company, I realized that after about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, the phones didn't answer on a Friday afternoon because they were just gone.
They just left you?
They just leave, yeah.
Did that hurt your feelings?
And even over the lunch hour, during the middle of the week, they would never answer the phone. I thought, you know, if somebody's going to be calling up wanting product, they call it all hours of the day, you know? So I confronted them and said, you've got to have somebody on the switchboard. We're selling this product. People are going to be calling, you know? It wasn't web order. There was no web, you know? So it was 1997. The web was just beginning, really. Actually, there was a web, but it wasn't really that popular at that time. It was just coming up. Anyway, the point is, the short version of the story is that I got very frustrated with these guys. And by the way, the product quality wasn't that great either. So I just said, look, I'll just do this myself. I had a product at that point, and I had customers. People were actually buying the thing. It just needed to be marketed properly, needed to be manufactured properly, which they also were not doing correctly. So I just took all the technology back. They had no problem with that. They didn't really care that much. And I started hiring people to build this product. And that was the start of my company.
And the name of your company was?
Quantum Research Group.
Quantum Research Group. And I tell you what, our time is kind of up. We're going to continue this in the next podcast. We haven't even got to charge transfer sensing. What is charge transfer sensing and the impact that it had on touchscreen? So we'll do that next time on Mind Matters. Until then, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.